The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is about enlightenment, and through enlightenment, empowerment. And when I talk with people today on the streets of New York and around the United States, I'm concerned that we do not really understand much about the world in which we live. We're ignorant on geography. In fact, believe it or not, a high level of college students didn't even know where Hawaii was on a map. And people did not know many countries in the Middle East, almost no countries in Africa. But when I ask them about Tibet, and I ask them about the Dalai Lama, and China, and the conflict, with rare exception, there was simply a quizzical look. So in this segment of our program, we're going to do a little education, both in geography and history and relative politics, but also show you the deeper, more profound meaning of life for a lot of individuals living in a part of the world that we are not very familiar with. We're going now to the foothills of the Himalayas in India. My guest is a person who is a major spokesperson, if not the spokesperson, for the government in exile. He is the Prime Minister. He is Somdong Rinpoche, and he is considered a venerable individual. He is the first Prime Minister to be democratically elected directly by the Tibetan people and has served his role for two four-year terms in the Tibetan government in exile. He's one of the most beloved Tibetan lamas and teachers in the Tibetan community, having won the elections by over 90% of the caste votes. Rinpoche was instrumental for the creation and drafting of the Charter of Tibetans in Exile, and later the Constitution for the Future Tibet. He has painstakingly developed the government administration that may well be one of the most progressive in the world, especially dealing with climate change, the environment, compassionate economic development, political inclusivity, international relations, and based upon the fundamental principles of kindness, integrity, and compassion. Now, I know that many people listening right now are listening from the greater Washington, D.C. area, Baltimore, Washington, Virginia. Virtually all the governmental agencies have individuals who have, for a long time, since I've been broadcasting every single week for a quarter of a century, 25 years, out of Washington, D.C. on non-commercial WPFW, they listen. I get emails. When I go to lectures there, I conduct lectures. They come and they say, Gary, we may work in this agency that doesn't always do the right thing, but we want you to know there are many of us down here who are progressive, who do try to influence decisions within our capacity as best we can. So don't feel that you're talking to a city of vacuous minds. There are many of us who are indeed caring. And I know that. I know that that's our audience all over the world. 52% of all the people listening right now are listening throughout the world. My concern is this. Take a look at what we're doing now. We are creating a military footprint all over the world with over 600 definitely no military bases, but over 1,000 when you consider black op positions as well. We have insinuated ourselves within the governments of Pakistan and Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have a very, very warped perspective of how to bring peace to the world. And then look at home. I travel everywhere all the time, and I travel as just a regular person who has never forgotten where I came from. A small community in West Virginia, arriving in New York City with $9 from a Greyhound bus, and never have allowed anything that's I've been fortunate enough to experience in the way of success or public acceptance to separate me from everyone else. As a result, I go to where people are. Yesterday I was in the South Bronx. I spent the entire afternoon talking with people on one street in the middle of the South Bronx where they have very articulated views concerning how Wall Street got bailed out, but the people of the South Bronx and Harlem did not, how The major corporations have all the power in Washington with their lobbyists, but they do not. And even some of the spokespersons who are elected officials are not there to speak on behalf of these people. As one man said when he turned around, he said, Gary, look at all these buildings. They're being boarded up, and look at all these storefronts. This was on Fordham Road. He says, look at how many of these. He says, I'm 77 years old, he said. And at one time, this was a thriving neighborhood, a middle-class neighborhood. There was not very much crime. It was safe. People had joy. People had meaningful jobs. He said, now, it's filled with crime. People are desperate. There's a great deal of drugs and gangs. And he said, our government does nothing more than send in police, but does not send in the aid. Empty buildings that should be reclaimed. In any case, in his discussion, which I was filming for a new film on People Before Profits, is my new film, my new documentary about poverty, the new poverty in America. He said, we have been left out of the equation, but only those in the Washington consensus are in the equation. And by the way, he was an extremely articulate individual who gave a great deal of insights. And as the crowd gathered during the filming, more and more people continued to voice their concerns and say, yes, talk about this, talk about that. Now, why do I say this when I'm going to be interviewing unlimited time here with no commercial interruptions, the Honorable Ripoche? Because imagine now the challenges that his country and his people have had, excluded, exiled, tortured, murdered, thousands of temples destroyed, a culture, in effect, wiped from the face of the earth, much as Mao Zedong earlier had wiped out much of China's history because it wasn't politically correct to what his ideas and his dogma was. So I'm hopeful that some of his insights and what he's been able to do, virtually with no news about what he's doing anywhere in the United States, to become possibly words that we can be informed by, motivated by, inspired by, and then take that through our independent and progressive movements into a third party. That said, let me just also mention that the Honorable Rinpoche is an ardent follower of Mahatma Gandhi and the dialectics of J. Krishnamurti, who I knew and befriended in his life. He was a dear friend of his until Krishnamurti's passing. Welcome to our program, sir.
Thank you.
There are just a few other little things. In America, we see Free Tibet stickers all over the place, but most people do not know what that really means as the government in exile understands it. So I would like you to clarify the difference between an autonomous Tibet and a free Tibet as a separate nation. And then, is there any unique role that His Highness the Dalai Lama and you envision the government in exile now, and perhaps later in an autonomous Tibet, playing in the larger global community of nations? For example, do you see any future membership in the UN or any other national bodies? And secondly, explain to us what the government in exile hopes and dreams and wishes are to begin a serious dialogue with China. But people won't understand why China has taken over, in effect, annexed, and is now colonizing Tibet unless you give us a overview of the history of Tibet and its relationship with China, because China claims Tibet is its sovereign country. Please give us the historical lessons first.
You have quite well explained a bit of history. Tibet's history is a little complicated because the Tibet has never been expressed her sovereignty over the other nations all the time, although Tibet remained sovereign, independent. Around the Tibet kingdom was started 200 BC. Till 1951, it remained a separate nation. But in the 13th century, for about 60 years, Tibet had been occupied by Mongolians, started the invasion of Genghis Khan. But later on, China was also invaded by Mongolian, and the Mongolian Emperor dynasty was started. And then the Kublai Khan, the second emperor of China, has given back the entire Tibet to his teacher, Dongun Chuchil Papa, and it was around 1265. And since then, 1951, Tibet remained a separate nation. But all the time, she remained aloof, and there has not been any international relationship, even with the neighboring countries. During British India, there have been strange relationship with British India. Whenever the British India suits, Tibet was treated as a sovereign independent, and whenever they doesn't suit, they think the Tibet is, they consider Tibet as a autonomous region of China. That's why the Tibet image and Tibet's position has never been very clear to the international scenario. Then it was 1949, China was overthrown, the former Chinese nationalist government was overthrown by the Communist Party, and just thereafter, the Tibet was invaded by a military force, the so-called Liberation Army of the People's Republic of China, and half of Tibet was occupied by 1950, and then thereafter there have been negotiations with the PRC authorities, and it was 23rd May 1951, the so-called 17-point agreement was concluded, and in that agreement says the Tibet was a part of China and remained separate for a long period of time. Now she is returned back to the mainland and main home. And then the Tibet government, at that time the Soviet Tibet government, become a state, the autonomous government of the People's Republic of China. His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama tried his level best to remain as an autonomous region of PRC for 8 years, and finally the agreement has been violated by PRC intentionally. Then finally the peaceful revolution, and His Holiness and his government has been has to take refuge in India, and since then for the last 51 years around 100,000 Tibetans and His Holiness and his government is remained in India. And As soon as His Holiness arrived in India, in SL, and his government was also with him, and he started to democratizing the Tibet setup, and now we are fully democratized, and we have a legislative body elected by the Tibetans in the diaspora, and also the executive has been elected, Kalin Chiba, and his cabinet is elected by the people. And His Holiness, as the head of state and as the head of government, oversees the administration. But the major political decisions have been taken by the elected leadership. So in SL, in a different country, we can't have a separate judiciary. But in lieu of judiciary, we have a justice commission. And our own internal matters can be tried in that justice commission. So we have a separate organs of all the three departments, and then we are also having now Tibetans almost every country, about 45 countries in Asia and West. We have small communities, and in North America also now Tibetan population is quite large. I think more than 10,000 people are living now in North America. And all of them are able to participate in the process of election of their political leadership and so forth. Although the government in exile do not recognize by any other government, but still we are functioning in the eyes of the Tibetan people living inside Tibet or living in diaspora, they think that this setup is their own legitimate governance. So in this way, in the eyes of our host country, we are a kind of administration of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which is called Central Tibet Administration of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In the eyes of the Tibetans, their own elected political leadership and their government in exile. So by this way, we are trying to find a solution to the Tibet problem. For the last 35 years, His Holiness is pursuing a consistent policy of a middle path approach. We are not seeking separation, but a genuine autonomy for all the Tibetan people. And for this purpose, we are negotiating with the PRC leadership since year 2002, and a 9-round of talks has been already concluded. And in the last round, in the 8th round, we have submitted a memorandum to them in which what kind of autonomy we are seeking for has been submitted to them. And in the 9th round of talk in this year, February this year, we also again submitted a note on that memorandum to clarify some of their misunderstandings. So His Holiness is very open and ready to accommodate their concerns and voices, but PRC leadership is appear to be do not have any political will to find amicable solution to the Tibet problem, and the situation inside Tibet has never been improved. On the contrary, each year there has been a deterioration, and particularly 2008. There have been a widespread of peaceful demonstrations and showing disagreement, which has been repressed by force and by torture and by killing and imprisonment. And the situation inside Tibet is so tense. But Tibetans in diaspora, we are about 150,000 outside Tibet. They are trying to preserve the Tibet cultural heritage and also finding a solution to the Tibet problem for the future generation of the Tibetans to come. So this is, in a nutshell, I could explain how we are functioning or how we are conducting our activities. And we are totally committed to non-violence and truthful. So truth and non-violence is our basic commitment and our basic stand.
Okay, let me just reiterate, sir, for our audience, because we do have a very strained technical connection. So I'm asking our audience to please understand we're speaking with the Prime Minister in exile of the Tibetan people, along with the Dalai Lama. And these are the two most influential individuals within that community of 150,000 living at the base of the Himalayas. So we're lucky just to have this connection. So please bear with us. I realize it's difficult with a difference in language and a technical connection to understand, but I will repeat anything that I feel may not be fully understood so that you get the message. And my guest is just a little background on who you're listening to. The Prime Minister Rinpoche was born in Tibet in 1939, and he escaped to India in 1959. He studied Buddhist philosophy at the great Drepung Monastery in Lhasa, and he holds degrees of a Doctor of Divinity and Tantric Studies, and later received what is called the highest academic degree in Tibetan Buddhism, called the Gisha. And it requires many more years of study than a Western PhD. He is a scholar. He is renowned throughout India and was selected as the chairman of the Association of Indian Universities, the first non-Indian to hold his position that oversees the educational development of almost 250 universities and colleges throughout India. And besides Buddhist philosophy, he's an ardent follower of non-violence. Now, what he is saying is this, that historically, throughout a long period of time, Tibet was an independent nation. And then it had a succession of invasions by Mongols. But then the Tibetan people still were able to be independent up until the 1950s when China invaded. And then there was a treaty, but it was a forced treaty. And the Dalai Lama had no choice. He was a young man at the time. But to acquiesce. Had he not acquiesced, then there would have been devastation, because the Chinese are known, in their political culture at least, for barbarism and a complete obliteration of their opponents. In any case, in spite of the fact that there was a treaty signed, more than 50,000 temples were destroyed. Thousands upon thousands of Tibetans who were not armed were slaughtered. And then in the last, let's say, 10 years, China took it upon itself to migrate into China tens of thousands of Chinese in order to, in effect, to colonize it by creating another new generation that would no longer have the same lineage, the same language. So even the denial of the language being spoken, the cultural things. So now when you go into the major cities, as many Chinese do, they're encouraged to go there because this massive railroad project will take you on a train, a modern train, right up until the mountains of Tibet, until their city and their capital. All the stores are Chinese, not native Tibetans. The schools do not allow their language to be taught as Chinese. So they literally have, in effect, usurped everything that was originally Tibetan. Now, Tibetans still live there, but when a peaceful demonstration, the protest, many of the inhumane conditions under which the Tibetans were living and lack of any freedoms were staged just 2 years ago, China came in and swooped down on them, arrested many, beat them, and killed them. There was mass pushback by the Chinese. And much like in Burma, Myanmar, when the Buddhists went to the streets by the tens of thousands, they had no weapons. They merely were chanting peaceful slogans. And the military junta came out and beat them and killed them. And their bodies were floating in the rivers. And their temples were sacked. And so they could take control, because peaceful demonstrations were not allowed. So on the one hand, what we have is we've had one president after the other. Barack Obama chose to show the Dalai Lama out the side door because didn't want to interfere with offending China, as did George Bush. Well, Bush didn't even pretend to be inspired by the Free Tibetan Movement. Then you had Bill Clinton, once again, realizing from his council, his business roundtable, look, there's no weighing this. We get our loans paid for by, we get our loans from China, not from Tibet. So therefore, we're importing all these goods from China, not Tibet, or not from the Tibetans in exile. So it's fine. So have the Dalai Lama for a photo shoot with Richard Gere and a few other celebrities. He'll go to Central Park and get, you know, 1,000 people coming to hear him say, talk. But let's just keep it at the fringe. But let's not make any policies that would really show that we support the free and independent Tibetan movement. But we have done just that with China's other, let's say, challenged asset, and that is Taiwan. We have backed Taiwan. We have a military treaty with Taiwan. If Taiwan is ever invaded, the United States must take the side of Taiwan, and therefore causes a real conundrum. So that's why China has not, up to this point, invaded Taiwan. But we didn't have any such treaty. And it's unfortunate where Taiwan is recognized by the United Nations, the Free Tibet Movement is not. So it's a visitor only, with a visitation status in the foothills of India, but is not recognized as such by the world's governments, which don't want to offend China. Why? Because China just last week became the second most influential industrial nation in the world. It passed Japan. It wasn't supposed to be for 15 years, but it happened. So now we're faced with this. Let's take an honest look at China. It is creating more environmental pollution than any other country in the world, because it has about one to two new major power plants being constructed per week, and these are not stopping pollution. They're actually contributing to pollution. One-third of all the pollution that goes into California air comes from China. They are using, in effect, slave labor for an enormous amount of their industrial product creation. Their society is overgrowing too fast. They have too many people wanting a westernized lifestyle with more cars and food, and they do not have the sustainable resources to supply them with the oil. They're oil depleted. They're having to make oil deals with the Sudan, a genocidal government, with Russia, a criminal government, and with Nigeria, a criminal and negligent government. And so then they become the protectors of these. They are a major exporter of arms around the world. They are in gross violation of every single human rights. They've arrested over 1 million members of a peaceful meditation group, the Falun Gong, and they have special military hospitals where they extract these individuals' eyes, kidneys, hearts, livers for transplants. Completely healthy people held and chained in beds, and then when you need a donor, you've got all your own donors there. They do this against all of the laws, international laws being broken. They don't care. China doesn't care what anyone in the world thinks, because everyone's dependent upon China. And they know that. They've intentionally kept their currencies low, undervalued, because then it means that they're not competing in a fair world. They've taken millions of jobs in the United States and opened up factories there. And so the United States is literally tied its rope around its own neck and around China's arm. And if China stopped giving us money today, we would be insolvent within 6 months. So what can we say to China? How about nothing? What have we said to China for being a virtually genocidal state? Nothing. The Chinese government is run by oligarchs, criminal gangs, with the official moniker. And so as a result, as Americans, the average American is clueless, the average politician is helpless, the political leaders are impotent, and the news media is indifferent. So now what we have is we have a gentleman on the phone now telling us about the history. Now we're going to go into, and by the way, since the government in exile is based upon democratic principles, elections are conducted with all registered Tibetan refugees living in many different countries around the world, voting to elect a prime minister and parliament members, and the prime minister envisions this continuing in an autonomous Tibet within the Chinese system, where politicians stand in China as oligarchic privileged elite within the upper echelons of the Communist Party, and where elections have no role. So it's really irrelevant in China who gets elected anything, because they don't care. They don't have to. They have absolute power, and they'll arrest you. There's no freedom of speech, no freedom of assembly, no freedom of the press, no freedoms at all. And yet we brag about how it's a great partner. Well, that's like having Jack the Ripper as a partner and taking him to a sorority party. I mean, my goodness. And I'm concerned that Americans have no sense of history today. So now, sir, back to the karma of nations. Now, the topic is inspired in me when the former Mongolian president, Enkarbair, contributed an article to Richard Gehl's magazine, where he was the editor-in-chief for many years. Buddhism explains phenomena as a creation of cause and effect, or the complex of many causes, rather than a result of a mere accident. If you think of the current economic crisis that is affecting most nations in the world, especially the United States and Europe, can we understand economics from a Buddhist perspective of causation and karma. And by karma, I mean a kind of accumulated potential power or weakness gained as a result of every deed done in the past. And what is karma's relationship to accountability and being responsible for the results of our actions? For example, in the case of the world banking system that went wild with greed and power, and with no concern for ethics, and that has resulted in the suffering of millions of families. We usually think of karma as applying only to an individual person, but do nations and groups and religions as collectives have karma? Your thoughts, please.
Yes. Karma is the most powerful driving force for the well-being or the miseries of the people. And the principle of causality is, of course, a real principle of the things how happen. Whatever things happen in this universe, there need to be a cause, and each cause has an effect. And that effect will again create a cause, and the cause and the effect, the cycle goes on. I think this principle cannot be denied even the science viewpoint. And as far as the karma of individuals and the karma of nations are concerned, every individual is not an individual related to any other person. Each individual comes into being, lives and dies with the association of the society, other people and other beings. So therefore we are animal of a kind of group and society. So therefore we also have a collective karmic force. Each individual has an individual karmic force, and each group has a collective karmic force, and similarly the nations has also a collective karmic force. But this karmic force does not mean that individuals cannot alter it. Individuals has no power to build one's own karmic force. The karma is to be accommodated by individual itself with her, free will. And in spite of that, the past accumulated karma shall have to be accountable. And therefore, in the nutshell, the principle of causality and the principle of the karma and the result of karma are not different. It is the same thing. And at this moment, the karmic force of humanity has been much polluted by the economic value, which has been considered the only value of human life. And in sake of accumulation of wealth and accumulation of money, the system of system of economy which is prevailed in this world today is not based on the sense of universal responsibility or in the sense of compassion or sense of love, and it is always in the sense of competition and the sense of winning and the sense of give lose to the others. By this way, the foundation of love and compassion has been destroyed by the greed, and the greed has prevailing over everything. So unless we address to the evil of human greed, I don't think there can be any problem can be solved for a permanent basis. The violence, the problem of violence cannot be put an end by counter-violence. The problem of environment degradation, which cannot be again solved by scientific methods or any other spending money or something like that. Unless and until we do not restore the inner environment of the human mind, the outer environment is not going to be restored. And similarly, the greed has no end, and no individual or no nation will have at any time sufficient wealth and a sufficient economy, and they will stop to further exploitation of the people and exploitation of nature. So therefore, the real real remedy of every problem of humanity or sentient beings of today, we shall have to address to the greed and the human selfishness. And unless and until the human greed and the human selfishness can be eradicated, I don't think there is no end of the problem for the humanity of today. The Tibet problem, the conflict between PRC and Tibet is not an absolute thing. It is a symptom of a larger human malady. And that larger human malady is pervasive to everywhere. Every nation and every individual is today suffering from so many problems. The problem of environment degradation, problem of terrorism and war and violence, and problem of economic disparity and competition and so forth. There's no end. Even the source of salvation, the religions, now the religions are disappeared. The names and institutions of religions are remained there, and this also become a cause of conflict and competition and violence. So therefore, wherever the humanity has touched, that has become a kind of conflict and source of conflict and nature of conflict. So therefore, it is very high time to address, to look to the real cause of all problem, that is human selfishness and human greed, which is come out of the human ego. And unless we inquire into oneself and we look into the oneself, how the individual does exist and how he or she is interrelated and interdependent with all universe and all other beings, I don't think there is any solution to any problem.
I really appreciate the deep and powerful insights in your answer. In one sense, it speaks to the need of likes to come together, the greed within the United States, and having exceeded its capacity to maintain its own lifestyles because of greed and its military conquest because of greed, is now attached to China as a provider of the funds to maintain that, and therefore an unholy alliance. I just want to go a little further into what you said and put it into lay language that people in my own audience may be able to better understand. If we apply the Buddhist principle that every individual is unique and therefore each follows its own path of development, is this also not true, the uniqueness of individual nations and their political and economic systems? And if this is true, then what are your views about the Western strategy of single models of political governance and economic theory that is believed by Americans as the best and should be applied universally across all nations? In this case, being America's idea of democracy, like, and therefore we're going to bring democracy to Iraq, democracy to Afghanistan, democracy to Iran, and with that, our model of free market capitalism. And since we've just seen some of the exit of some of our combat troops out of Iraq and heralding that as a major achievement, of course we didn't pay attention to the 50,000 troops left behind and the 100,000 private contractors under arms left behind, so therefore making the gesture of what we just eliminated out of the country really meaningless. An ethical economic theory would be an economy that finds ways for people to live sustainable and fulfilling lives within their individual community as well as in the human community of all nations. So if you were to try to define an economic theory based upon Buddhism's principles of causation and karma and compassion, I'd like to know what that economy would be. And I want I just want to share a short quote from the human development from the former president of Mongolia, Nambarin Inkbayar, and ask your comments. He says, if someone or some nations have reached a relatively better level of existence, in our sense, development, then other people or nations, it is immoral. And because of its immorality, it will be impossible to further develop without feeling the pain of the underdeveloped nations, both humans and countries. Now, what I understand the Mongolian president as saying is that the more you help others to improve, the better quantitative and qualitative you can develop yourself. Do you agree, and would you elaborate on that idea?
Yes, I do agree to that idea, and I may not be able to much elaborate that idea. The basic thing is that every sentient being cannot be survive and live happily without giving happiness to others. If you make all other sentient beings unhappy, then you cannot expect yourself to remain happy. So this nature of interdependence, give and take, and sharing, that only brings prosperity. Accumulation of wealth by one nation, one person, one group, that means you are accumulating a wealth which is not belonging to you, which is share of the others. The Gandhi has said a very beautiful sentence that he said that Mother Earth has a sufficient supply to satisfy every living creature on it, but the Mother Earth cannot satisfy a single person's greed. So this is the real real thing which he has understood. We have accumulated unnecessary things by nations, by groups, and by companies, and by multinational cooperations. And their accumulation of wealth is robbing of somebody else's share. And they are deprived of their necessity things. So that is because we do not have a compassionate mind to all the sentient beings. If you have a compassionate mind, love to everyone, then you will definitely share whatever you have in your position. And by sharing, then there would be an equality. And if there is an equality, there would be a sense of brotherhood. As you mentioned about democracy, yes, democracy is very necessary, and democracy is the best system to govern a nation or a people or a society. But today, the real, genuine democracy is very rare to achieve. Equality can achieve only among the equalities. Equality to all unequal people are very difficult to achieve. And simply, if we look to the United Nations, it is the highest and the largest institution of the nations on this earth. But that organization is most undemocratic, and around 200 member nations, but things are decided by one nation, and it is not governed by the will of majority. It is governed by will of minority, not only minority, will of one. So this kind of things are still happening in this world. Even the so-called very democratic countries, there are also the will of minority is being overpowered by the will of the majority. Actually, a sense of cooperation and a sense of unity is not able to create among the people. So again, I'm coming back, unless and until you have a really caring and a compassionate mind to all sentient beings, we may not be able to achieve even that so-called democracy.
I appreciate those insights. I just have one more major question for you, but it has a few components. And just one of the thoughts I have, since the role of attachment is perceived in Buddhism as a major impediment to discovering peace and contentment and truth, and only perpetuates in the end suffering, then that means that the national attachment of our identity, of a super identity on steroids, further creates suffering and contributes to an economic system that only further increases the haves and have-nots, and that's what we see today. It's not that we do not have enough money or resources to help everyone, including those people in the South Bronx, or the people in Harlem, or people in Queens. I'm just talking about around New York City where I was filming yesterday. But everywhere I went, everyone said, with all the money given away, why didn't we have anyone come here to help us? And I said to them in my own way that, well, it wasn't meant to help you. It was meant to help those who felt that they were privileged. And their need is for attachment. But I've never met a happy, rich person that identified themselves through their attachments. You have to have a larger sense of self that goes beyond attachments. Now, that's my own thoughts. Now to my last issue I'd like you to address, please. The environment and climate change and the importance of organic farming and the moving towards a vegetarian diet and lifestyle. These, to me, are extremely important because these are things that each of us as individuals and small groups and collectives and communities can do, irrespective of the political juggernaut of our federal government, which does nothing on these. The lip service, but does nothing and will not do anything. The Democrats and Republicans are too corrupted by their own ideologies and greed to make any fundamental change that will ever help anybody, and they pass laws that have no bearing upon real change. Now, I've done many programs in the past on climate change, more than any other radio program in the United States, possibly the world, and the health dangers of pesticides and chemicals, future food and water shortages, the global threats to food production posed by genetically modified crops, and many of the best minds in the world on these topics have appeared on my program, including someone I know you know, Dr. Vandana Shiva, who we're filming this week in India, and Professor James Lovelock and Lester Brown, and hundreds of others. And when I interviewed Vandana last week for a film we're doing on sustainable living and the future of food and agriculture vis-a-vis climate change, she mentioned you, and with great respect. So here's my questions. There is more and more evidence that climate change and the huge threats it poses are a result of human activities, such as relying upon fossil fuels and increased pollution. And the future of the planet is dire if this continues at its current pace and millions of people will suffer. Similar to the question of causation and karma in the group of questions that I just asked you, how do you see this whole phenomena playing out as far as an environmental crisis, its impact upon water, food, quality of life, and sustainability? Your thoughts, and then my final idea is your feelings about vegetarianism from the Buddhist perspective, from the ethical perspective as well.
Yes, you have right pointed out that the attachment is a cause of greed, and also attachment is come out of greed. And that is caused by not recognizing yourself as you are. You have imposed something different, which may call in English language as ego, and in our own language it is Atma Dharma. There's no an independent, absolute essence of self, but you conceive an independent and absolute nature of self, which is unchanging and which is a kind of permanent, which causes, which creates a kind of feeling that the independent of I shall have to be satisfied by all kind of material things. You need wealth, you need fame, you need people, you need everything. And in response, you never realize the need of the others. And that's why the inequality and the basis of friction and conflict comes from that kind of mis conception. And this, that misconception is cleared, then the real nature of I is recognized, then that is a dependent nature, related to everything. So therefore you have to have a love and compassion. If you have love to yourself, you have to love to all sentient beings and all non-sentient beings as well, because you are also depend on nature and you are depend on everything. So once you have a sense of unconcerned and a kind of carelessness to the nature, that is the real cause of the climate change. And the climate change, how it is dangerous, we do not need any more evidence. During last 1 month, we have witnessed the wash away of the more than half of the Pakistan and burning of the large area of jungle in Russia and in India, the highest place of Leh Ladakh, which never had any rain in any time, has been washed away by flood. And this kind of unthinkable happenings and human miseries are happening. So there's no more evidence about the real danger and real the bad situation of climate change. This kind of attachment causes a lot of violence and conflict. So therefore, we should understand the interdependence of self, which can create love and compassion. And that love and compassion will also lead you to free from violence to any sentient being. Then, of course, you have to be a vegetarian. And if you are not a vegetarian, you are bound to cause harm and killing of animals for your food. Then similarly, you have to have an organic farming, without which the chemical agriculture also causes killing of larger insects and other things. So therefore, organic farming and vegetarianism is a way of life who believe in no violence and coexistence of all sentient beings. And I hope by practice of understanding of self and understanding of others, and through which a compassionate mind could be created, and which can bring a peace and harmony among the all sentient beings and among human beings, for which I pray too. Thank you.
Well, let me just conclude by saying that I very much appreciate you taking your time to share your insights with us. Could you only imagine what would be the impact if you had a chance with the Dalai Lama to sit with the President and to explain how, through nonviolence and through compassion for all life and through the denunciation of greed, what we could do to make it a better world, and also to help Americans with some sense of real equality. I very much appreciate it. My guest, speaking by phone from the foothills of the Himalayas, the Prime Minister in exile, he is the Honorable Samdong Rinpoche, and I thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. And for
those who have had the patience to sit and listen to his statements, I realize some of the things you could understand that he was saying, probably some of them a little difficult because you have both a language issue and you have a static on the line and some of the technical difficulties. But one of the reasons the Progressive Radio Network has had astronomical increases in audience. And by the way, just last month, over 1,122,000 people came on just to my show to download it, new audience, is because we will go after these kind of interviews. We will bring you an interview that no one else in radio would want to because, well, of all the things, the deeper thoughts, things that are not topical hot-button issues, but cause us to think on a more profound level. And that's true of all the different programs you'll hear, whether it's Sandy Schechter or Michio Kaku, or Jim Hightower, etc. Have a nice day, everyone.